Welcome to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're talking with the State Consumer Advocate about our changing green energy landscape and a broad discussion about the responsibilities of his office. Dean Ushina has been with the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs for about 25 years. Good morning, Dean.
Good morning.
So glad that you're back again in the saddle here. This is really an exciting time. I mean, there's a lot going on facing our state right now.
Yeah, I have to agree with you 100%. There are a lot of interesting things going on in the energy industry, in the telecom industry, transportation. A lot of things are going on. So it's very challenging for our office to try to keep up with all of those things.
Yeah, I imagine. Lots of big dockets. We just came off the big PUC decision with NextEra and Hawaiian Electric. So that was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was. I know that was a topic that was of interest to virtually everybody in the state, as Hawaiian Electric Company serve most of the residents and businesses in the state of Hawaii. Right now, there are other big dockets going on before the commission involving, changing the regulation of those electric companies as we move forward into the future. Because this isn't your grandfather's Oldsmobile, and it's not your grandfather's electric company either. So
yeah, talk about that. You know, because the big thing, the big model was the whole decoupling issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so decoupling actually came about originally from, there was an agreement in 2008 between the Hawaiian Electric Companies and the state to try to help provide incentive for the electric companies to not be as opposed to the idea of energy efficiency and renewable energy. So decoupling was a means by which that if their sales went down, they were still able to recover some of the lost sale revenues. So that was maybe the first major step into changing the way the electric utility companies were being regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. And what we're doing right now in the PBR docket, the performance-based regulation docket, is maybe the next evolution of that. As we continue to evolve in terms of how services are being provided to consumers, we recognize that there's a need to change the way the electric utility companies are being regulated by the commission as well.
Right, and this way the company's rewarded for its efforts toward moving us toward our green energy goals.
Right. So there are supposed to be a number of outcomes that are being identified as what either state goals are or maybe other type of goals in terms of trying to advance the utility companies in a certain direction. And depending on how well they do, that's going to be a determining factor as to how they are able to collect their revenues.
And, you know, we should make note of a bright spot on the landscape. Clearway Energy held a blessing for three large solar farms yesterday afternoon, Waipio, Mililani, Kawailoa. Alan Oshima, the CEO and president of Hawaiian Electric, talked about the company's progress toward higher renewable energy yields.
We are at approximately 30%, which is the goal by 2020. All the projects are in the pipeline, ready to start commercial operation, will get us to 30% and higher. But things happen, right? So nobody predicted that, for example, geothermal would be overrun by Madam Pili last year. So we're working with them to see what can be brought up in the near future, hopefully at a better price for our customers.
You know, and there was there's a lot of talk about microgrids. You know, we saw that experience on the Big Island. You know, how do we become more resilient? And hopefully some of these projects will help us do that.
Yeah, there are a number of dockets going on before the commission, one of which involves microgrids and seeing what we can do to improve the resiliency of the electric service on the islands. One of the things that, you know, our office is trying to make sure is that when we look at resiliency, I think some of the other parties are looking at microgrids as an opportunity to reach out to individual customers to help them. But we're trying to make sure that when we look at the topic of resiliency and microgrids, we're looking at everybody's needs, and it's certainly the urgent needs in terms of whether or not first responders will have energy so that they can actually go out and take care of their business, as well as, you know, hospitals and other important facilities, so that if, and God forbid, something happens where a Category 3 or 4 hurricane hits us, we will hopefully be in a position where we can make sure that those entities that are supposed to be there to help customers and businesses are able to do so with power on hand. I think in terms of some of those big projects going on, I think one of the things our office has been trying to do as well is make sure that the prices for those projects are at a reasonable price. Historically, we've seen some significant differences in terms of the prices for similar projects on the mainland versus Hawaii. And our Division of Consumer Advocacy has been trying to make sure that those prices are brought to Hawaii so we can actually enjoy lower energy prices.
And I think we did in these three, because this was a project that was under Sun Edison, and then they got pushed into bankruptcy, and then now everything was on hold.
But right.
So this is a startup
right.
of those projects.
Right, right, exactly. And I think you had, as part of your conversation last Friday with Murray Clay and Peter Rozig, talked about some of the ongoing RFP projects. And then there was a phase one. Now there's a phase two that's going on. There's also got separated from phase two, but then there's an effort to develop requests for proposals for projects on the island of Molokai and Lanai as well, so that we can bring some of those low-cost renewable energy projects to those islands as well. And I'd like to point out, I mean, I know for a while there's been rooftop solar, which helps individual customers. But one of the good things is if we can bring in low-priced utility-scale projects, that benefits all customers. Because if we can replace the dirty fossil fuel power that's generated at a higher cost with low-cost renewable energy, that flows through to all customers rather than just helping out a specific customer.
We did talk to William Giese, the executive director of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association. He gives credit to the early adopters of rooftop solar systems. He believes that they helped everyone, not just themselves. He says this happened as the Hawaii Energy Office began to push to get customers, you know, educated, to get them to conserve and reduce their energy bills and their usage. Here's what he had to say.
The proof is in the pudding, almost, that these two giant things happened. Average bills went down despite total generation going down. So there clearly seems to be a net benefit from these rooftop PV systems. I think the other point, too, is that HECO themselves have realized that rooftop PV is going to be a huge part of their renewable portfolio standard, 40%, which right now it's at about 38%. Right. So when we get to 100% renewable generation, 40% of that will be rooftop PV. They say as much in their power supply improvement plan.
So there's room for both.
There has to be, really. I think to get to 100%, we're going to have to look at all of our available resources. And when I say resources, that includes land, because I think one of the things that we, as a very small state, we don't have the same resources in terms of available land space that, say, California or Arizona does. So it's not as if we can put up large 500-megawatt utility-scale plants anywhere on the island. We have to be very mindful of making sure that we have land for growing food and other purposes. So we'll have to look at rooftop as a important and likely significant contributor to reaching 100%.
Now, there have been lots of conversations about using ag land for a lot of these large utility-scale projects. We just had some controversy because I think there was one developer that wanted to use it on prime ag lands just because cost-wise it made sense for them. But there was some pushback and some concern over that. And I think with these projects, I think the plan at one point had been to use sheep to help keep the grass down.
Right.
So I think that's still part of the plan. But, you know, they're looking at ways to be able to use some of our limited space.
Right, right. I think that's something that we'll continue to need to look at in terms of how we can maximize the use of the land. That was the issue of using prime ag land was something we raised in one of our statements of positions before the commission in terms of whether or not that particular project should be approved, because there are other land sites available. And actually, that's one of the things that we've been trying to really push before the commission as well, is making sure that community input is considered as it relates to some of these projects. Because sometimes what happens is a developer goes to a landowner and they establish an agreement to use the land for a project, but they really haven't gone out to the community to see whether or not the community might have some concerns about, say, a wind farm going up in a particular location, or even solar panels, because sometimes what happens with solar panels is it may cause glare for customers who live in the area, or they're just not used to having that particular project in their area and have some concerns. And I think it's really important that the community concerns be addressed before we simply move forward with some of those projects.
Right, because there is going to be some community pushback with whatever project is proposed, just because you know, if you're not used to seeing anything there, and then you see just acres and acres of solar panels,
right.
It's kind of like jarring.
Right.
Or, you know, if you've got very tall power turbines, wind turbines in your neighborhood as well.
Right. And that will be very visible, especially when it's the wind turbines. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We have a couple of calls already. Art from Makiki, you have a question?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's on your mind?
You know, the Hawaiian Electric has been made hundreds of millions in profit over the last 5-6 years. And they were before the PUC right now asking for a $77 million rate increase. My question is, why doesn't Hawaiian Electric use this enormous profit it's making to pay for these upgrades that it's seeking to the rate increase for, instead of shoving it on the public?
Do you want to answer that, Dean?
Sure. Art must be a regular caller because I think he called in last Friday as well. I think that's a good question in terms of that's what a utility company does. They take their profits and then they use those part of the profits to then invest in projects. That's part of the reason we're looking at changing the regulatory scheme for the electric utility company, because the way the current system works, the more the company can invest in terms of capital projects, that influences the opportunity for profit on those capital investments. So essentially, the more they invest in capital projects, the larger profit they can make. So with those profits, they usually turn around and make more capital investments so that they can then improve on their profits. So that's exactly what they're doing in terms of taking their profits and making more investments. But with the new scheme, or I shouldn't say scheme, but the idea behind performance-based rate making is to break, and it's in part due to the legislation that was passed, Act 5 in 2018, to break the direct link between investment and profit, where rather than trying to encourage the utility company to always just invest capital in order to increase their profit, try to establish outcomes that is desirable in alignment with state objectives, and that's how they can increase their profit. So yes, they make a profit. Whether or not they make excessive profit, going back to decoupling, that was one of the things that we built in. When I say we built in, we encouraged that there be some limit to ensure that the utility company doesn't make more than they're supposed to. So there are collars essentially around what their authorized rate of return is, so that they don't have an opportunity to overearn. I think to date, I think the utility company would be quick to point out that they haven't come close to their authorized rate of return, and in large part because of the actions that we take in rate case proceedings before the Public Utilities Commission.
But I can see some people are probably bristling. You know, it's been a hot summer. They're probably using aircon if they've got aircon, and the bills are pretty high.
Right.
And so
right.
With the recent request for a rate hike,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're saying, well, you know, where's our savings if they're making these deals with these green companies and purchasing the power at a cheaper price? Why aren't we seeing any of that?
Right. Now, I mean, that's a good question. If I can touch briefly on that, I think, you know, where we will probably see the greatest savings is once the initial term of the contract is done, because the initial term of the contract is an opportunity for those developers to recover their capital investment. But assuming that those projects can continue to provide energy beyond the original term of the contract, that's where we've argued that at that point, you know, the price should be close to zero, because if they've already recovered their capital, the developers have recovered their capital investment, energy is free because they're getting it from the sun or the wind or whatever the case might be. And so rather than seeing, say, 9 cents, we should be looking at something closer to one cent or maybe even 2 cents just for the operating and maintenance expenses associated with maintaining those plants. And I do have to point out, on the mainland, again, this is where we're fighting hard to try to bring some of those prices into Hawaii, because recently we do see prices for PV projects in California or in some of the mainland states for 2 cents or less than 2 cents. And that's, you know, we'd love to see those prices here.
Right. Pass it on to the
right,
consumer.
Exactly. Exactly.
We have another call. Sue from Kaka'ako. What's your question for Dean?
Hi. I have a comment and then a question. Last week, there was a a discussion about Kauai and its rates, and the PUC people did not point out that Kauai has a co-op. I don't know how that would ever, you know, meld with what we pay here. But the fact is we pay the highest rate, which I know Dean knows, in the entire country. Okay, my question is this. From what I understand, Dean, you are the consumer advocate, so you're there to represent the user's interests, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so in appearing before the PUC on rates, have you been successful at all in convincing them to, you know, not grant the rates that the utility is asking for?
Sue, thank you for that question. I think depending on your perspective, there may be different judgments as to how well we do. But I can offer you, it is very rare that any utility company, whether we're talking about the electric companies, the small water and wastewater company, ever get the full increase that they request. For example, if I can point out one example, in the 2017 test year that was filed by Hawaiian Electric, they came in asking for, I think it was an 8% increase, which was maybe about a little over $90 million. The final decision and order that was approved by the commission, which was the result of our office's work on that particular case, as well as reaching a settlement. If I remember correctly, the number was there was an actual $600,000 decrease in their base rates. So that was a result of our hard work. And another example might be in a Young Brothers case a few years back. The company came in for a 4% increase, and essentially they were allowed maybe 88,000 as the total increase, which was effectively 0.01% increase over their existing rate. So I think our office has had success in terms of making the companies realize that they need to pull back on some of the requests, as well as sometimes if we can't reach a settlement and the issue goes before the commission, as a decision maker, they weigh the arguments that are presented by the utility in their application, as well as our recommendations in the testimonies, and then we get the results we do. So I'd like to say we've had success. I can't give you an exact number, but I know within the last couple of years, we've probably saved consumers well over, I want to say about maybe $170 million just in terms of the rate cases that have been filed by various companies and our ability to reduce the original request to a much lower amount.
Okay, and I know that there are there's some talk about possibly maybe Young Brothers coming in for another rate case,
yeah.
Rate hike.
We were informed that due to certain capital investments that Young Brothers has made in 2018 and 2019 and expect to make in 2020, that they would be coming in for both a 2019 and a 2020 test year. But they changed their plan, and my understanding is they may be coming in for a rate hike sometime later this month, and maybe looking at about almost $30 million in terms of an increase, which we will be looking at very closely to make sure that they are allowed only a reasonable increase for whatever cost that they may be incurring.
Right, because Young Brothers, you know, their service reaches everybody on the neighbor islands. You know, a lot of those goods come into Honolulu Harbor and then get dispatched out.
Right, right. Young Brothers is a very important provider of services to the consumers in terms of not only the neighbor islands, taking things that come in from the mainland to Honolulu, then to the neighbor islands, but bringing in produce and other goods from the neighbor islands back to Oahu for sale here. So, you know, we don't want them to struggle in terms of running into bankruptcy, but we certainly don't want them to have significant rate increases that may drive consumers and businesses on the neighbor island into bankruptcy. I mean, that's one of our major concerns in terms of making sure that there are reasonable rates.
Right, because, well, shipping's our lifeline,
right.
As an island state. We have seen the shipping companies, you know, the competition grow. Matson has the plans for the larger ships, the larger cranes. How does that landscape look to you at this point?
Yeah, that's one of the things we're trying to get a better understanding of, because to some degree, when Matson comes in, brings in the goods into Oahu, that's where Young Brothers steps in and helps to deliver those goods to the neighbor islands, because a number of the neighbor islands don't have ports large enough to allow Matson to deliver goods, say, from California to Lanai or Molokai. So that's where Young Brothers steps in. But if Matson decides that they can deliver goods to islands such as Maui, the Big Island, and reduces the amount of goods that are being transported by Young Brothers to those neighbor islands, that's going to change the landscape in terms of how Young Brothers is going to be able to serve those smaller islands as well, because some of the revenues that Young Brothers collects from serving the Big Island and Maui are used to help subsidize some of the rates for the smaller islands. Otherwise, again, the rates would be much higher, which we don't want.
Right, for Molokai, Lanai.
Right.
You know, and that's always the issue, right, when we hear about carriers coming in and the competition with those markets.
Right.
Who's going to serve those maybe less lucrative routes.
Right, exactly. I mean, we need to make sure that there's service to all the islands, not just the ones that are more lucrative for those carriers.
Okay. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. In our studio today is Dean Nishina. He is the state consumer advocate, and he's charged with protecting and advancing the interests of Hawaii consumers of regulated public utilities and transportation services and more. You can join the discussion by calling us at 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. You can join the discussion, so call us. Stay with us. We will be right back after a break.
Next time on The World, what we've forgotten about 9/11, a morning when no one knew what was going on.
Well into the afternoon, we were worried about other hijacked planes, that there were sort of more attacks coming the next day, the next month.
Author Garrett Graff pulls together first-person accounts that relive September 11th in the moment. Those stories on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
I think communication is vital, and I think because we have public radio, we have fair and unbiased communication that comes from a variety of perspectives. I think that's one of the few things we have left as a free nation, so it's really important to preserve that kind of communication, and public radio brings that to us.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
You are back with The Conversation, and Dean Nishida, our state consumer advocate, joins us in our studios to take your questions. Dean, you have a public hearing coming up for Kalailoa Water Company. Explain to us how that's all working, because I guess most people think, well, aren't most of us here on Oahu on the Board of Water Supply system?
Right. First, I'll point out it's a requirement for any time that a regulated public utility company wants to change their rates that a public hearing be held to give the public an opportunity to provide comments, to allow the Public Utilities Commission and our office to hear what, you know, their thoughts are about that particular rate increase. With respect to the provision of water service, the majority of customers on all the major islands are served by the county, but what happens is that certain areas, smaller areas, are not served by the county. That happens more frequently on some of the neighbor islands in terms of the more remote areas, where in order to, say, have a development, they need to make sure that there's utility service, which includes water. As it relates to Kalailoa, this was an area that was once owned by the military, and as part of the military's efforts to get out of areas that aren't within their core services, they sold the land that's being developed by Hunt, I believe, Hunt Corporation, and that's where Hunt tried to create a water utility company. I think the original certificate for public convenience and necessity application might have been filed back in 2014, but there have been a number of issues in terms of the company that is interested in taking it over, because the military didn't necessarily keep it up to county standards. And that's part of the reason, as I understand it, why the county didn't want to just take over the service in that area, because they would need to expend a number of dollars to bring it up to their code. And that's where Hunt, wanting to develop the land, was willing to try to create a utility company so that they could develop the land and then provide the water services to others.
So who are the customers out there?
So there are a mix of customers out there, where there are some commercial customers such as the Coast Guard, but there are also residential customers in terms of homes in that area. So what we're looking at is a rate increase, because when the original authority to provide utility service was granted back in maybe 2015, give or take, It was set at rates that the company was asserting that was not compensatory. So now they're trying to come in and get more money, essentially,
right,
so that they can look at maybe bringing up some of the system back up to closer to county code, as well as recover some of their operating and maintenance expenses.
Right, up to standard. And so that
right.
public hearing is going to be Tuesday, September 17th, 6 p.m., Kapolei Middle School.
Yeah, you know, if I can, mm-hmm. you know, I think I encourage customers, if you're able to come up to those public hearings. And actually, that's an issue that we've, when I say we, I've had discussions with Chair Griffin of the Public Utilities Commission about how we can try to encourage more customers to show up to these public hearings, because the public voices are very important in the process. And when people don't show up at some of these public hearings, what I don't want the Public Utilities Commission to think is that they don't care that there's a rate increase going on. So, you know, we have talked about whether or not there are ways to reach out through social media or other things to have people show up and express what comments and concerns about a proposed rate increase, so that the commission can hear what those concerns are.
Right, because you want feedback. You want to know what people are thinking, what they're experiencing.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
We have several calls on the line. Lonnie from Kailua Kona.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, why wouldn't Helco invest in batteries to store the energy that we're getting off of our rooftops and windmills? Thank you.
Lonnie, hi. That's a good question. Actually, that's one of the things that all of the utility companies are looking at. The cost of storage is coming down, and that's where it's becoming more cost effective. I think some of the earlier prices, the batteries weren't quite the most cost effective investment, but as prices continue to come down, that's where some of the recent proposals that came into the RFPs on all of the islands, they're actually combined projects. So it's PV and battery storage, so that they the utility company can take advantage of that storage to use the energy that's coming off during the day to try to help and serve some of the load that happens in the late evening, or not late evening, late afternoon and early evening. So yeah, batteries are part of the capital improvement or capital investment plans that we're looking at.
And I had shared with you my experience with batteries, that there had been a lag in getting the city and county, the DPP, to, I guess, come up with the rules and the permits needed in order to do battery storage, because it was still early on.
Right.
And as you mentioned, things have improved. But I'm hearing there's still some delay in actually getting, you know, those systems up and going because of the permit process. Anything you can do to help out on that end?
Yeah, I'd have to offer that falls somewhat outside of our area of influence, as you know, that's usually with the county in terms of permitting, and that has been an issue that's been come up with respect to whether it's rooftop systems or utility scale systems. And we do need to see if there are ways that we can make that permitting process a little easier. Not to say that we need to do away with it, but easier in terms of trying to get approval so we can move forward with these projects on a timely basis. Because sometimes, I'm sure as a customer, you want to get your savings as soon as possible. But sometimes there's also the concern that if the permitting process takes too long, there may be tax credit losses, available tax credits that may no longer be available if it takes too long, because some of those tax credits are being phased out.
Right.
So
you want to get take full advantage before they disappear. So
right.
Is there anything your office can do to help, you know, move the needle?
Again, you know, we have testified in certain hearings as it relates to legislation at the state level with respect to permitting things. But ultimately, it does come down to whether or not some of those permitting agencies, whether it's a state or a county agency, what they can do to streamline some of their processes.
Okay, we have another call. Patricia from Kailua. What's on your mind?
Aloha.
Hi.
Hi. My husband and I had solar on our entire roof just a couple of years ago installed, and I have solar air conditioning. So right now, I'm in the house. It's in the 60s. My dogs are comfortable. I'm comfortable. It's easy to breathe. And it's my bills occasionally have been minus, which is a lot better than 400-something in the past.
Yes, that's a. Do you have a question for Dean?
No, I really a comment, and I think people, if you're able to consider it, I think people should do that. It's a great savings.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much.
If I even though there was no question, I think I'd like to make an observation where she pointed out that sometimes her electricity bill is minus. That really shouldn't happen, and we know that's an existing quirk with the way some of the billing system works. But essentially, what's supposed to happen is that your electric system or your PV system, excuse me, might offset your kWh usage or your kilowatt hour usage. But there should be always a customer charge that gets collected because, going back to if I can offer the way things used to be done, rates there's a fixed rate that's collected and then there's a usage charge, and so your PV system is supposed to offset your usage charge, but the utility should be collecting that customer charge every month. As a matter of trying to encourage conservation, a lot of the fixed costs are embedded within that usage charge, and so when she says that her bill is negative, arguably there's no contribution coming towards those fixed charges. And what I'm talking about is there's a cost to install, say, the drop to your house, the lines that are used to serve your house. There's a cost to the distribution lines that are used to deliver energy to your house or even take energy from your house. And so if there's no contribution towards any of those fixed costs, arguably, those costs have to be recovered from other customers. So it's interesting that, you know, again, that there are negative bills really shouldn't happen.
Okay. We had another call on the line. Jim from the Big Island, he's shy, but his question, if corporations request rate increases to pay for infrastructure and equipment, then isn't investment tax deductible? Are they double dipping?
That's a good question. The state does have an investment tax credit, but it amounts to about maybe 4%. So what we try to make sure is if a company comes in and say they want to recover some of their investment as it relates to a capital project, that it's not the full amount. It's reduced by any capital investment tax credits they may get from either the state or the federal government, so that it's just the net amount that's being used to determine any rate increase. So it wouldn't be double dipping. We make sure, we go through it with a fine tooth comb in terms of making sure that they only are allowed to an opportunity to recover that which they're entitled to. But if they've already recovered portions of it, say from contributions from, sometimes a developer, what they'll do is they'll put in infrastructure and they'll build it and then they'll give it to the utility company. But if it's already built by somebody else, we don't let the utility company recover it again. We do look at those things.
Can you talk about smart meters? Because we're hearing a lot about that these days. What are the issues around that?
There are a number of issues surrounding smart meters. I think there's certainly the issue as it relates to health, because some consumers have read that some of those smart meters give off electromagnetic radiation that may affect their health. And certainly that's one issue that we are looking at. But another issue that relates to smart meters is the data that's being collected, because some consumers are concerned that with all of the data that is being collected by these smart meters, the electric utility might be able to tell when you're cooking, when you're taking a shower, when you're not home, because your electricity is low. So that the data privacy is a very important issue that's going on before a number of jurisdictions across the nation, including ours. As we continue to move forward with the evolution of the way services are being provided to customers, privacy issues are something that we're trying to make sure stays in the forefront so that it doesn't get ignored or somehow slips through the cracks.
So will there be opportunity for hearings about this, or, you know, for public input? I don't know. I don't know if there's anything before the PUC.
Right now there's a proceeding called the Grid Modernization Docket, and I think I'm not sure there be public hearings, but this is where, I would encourage customers, if they have concerns such as data privacy, that they should send in communications to the Public Utilities Commission. You can always submit public comments. If I remember off the top of my head, I think their email address is puc@hawaii.gov, or you can certainly send a letter to the commission saying, I have concerns or I have questions regarding this particular matter or any matter. Their street address, if I remember correctly, is 465 South King Street, room 103, Honolulu, Hawaii, 96813. And when you send those comments in, it will become part of the record that's before the commission.
Is there anything that your office can do to help reach out across the board, across the state, to consumers just to find out what they're thinking on some of these issues, you know, to initiate some kind of a survey?
That's a really interesting question. Thank you. We do have our own website, and we do have a Facebook page. But for years, what I've been trying to see is whether or not it's feasible for our office to look into conducting statewide surveys. There's so far, the research that I've done is fairly significant, but I think it's a worthwhile investment if we can try to somehow fit that within our budget, or if there's a way we can partner up with, say, other state agencies such as the DBET, you know, who does their own surveys, say, through when you come back on a plane and there's that survey. If there are ways we can try to get more feedback from customers on energy issues, on water issues, I think that'll be really important feedback for our office as well as the commission. So that's been something I've been trying to push for a few years, but it does take a little work in terms of trying to get a good understanding of how to conduct those surveys, as well as trying to figure out how to pay for those surveys.
Right, because you've got to probably make the ask through the state legislature.
Right.
And we have seen the PUC make the ask for additional staff because we've got more complicated dockets coming through the door. And with technology happening and changing the landscape, not just for energy, but for transportation, like with Uber and Lyft and all these different models that are getting turned on, you know, their heads. I mean, it's complicated. And so, yeah, if PUC is ramping up, does your office need additional staff to respond to some of these things?
Yeah, I that is something that we are trying to work on. This past legislative session, I did request additional positions, and we were granted 5 positions, but we were unfortunately, the legislature also took away some of our existing positions that were vacant. It was sort of a trade-off. So we didn't really ramp up. We did kind of take maybe 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. But we are looking to try to increase the resources we have available as we start to look at all of these new complex and increasing workload changes.
Okay, so basically, until you can get to a point where you can do a survey like this, the key points are when these hearings happen, when there are dockets, that people provide input.
Right, exactly. That's why, again, I urge, you know, consumers, to the extent that you have a comment that you'd like to share, to make sure you send those comments in, because right now, as you just mentioned, until we can get that survey rolling, that is the main touch point between the Public Utilities Commission and consumers in terms of those public hearings.
Okay, we had another call on the line, Jeremiah from the Big Island, another shy caller. His question, why is it okay for big cell phone companies to ship lithium-ion batteries to the state of Hawaii, but not for the individual consumer themselves? You know anything about that?
Yeah, that's not something I have any knowledge about. I think I can share Jeremy's concerns, because there are times that we've tried to order certain things that have lithium-ion batteries, but I'm not sure why there are those limitations, other than the safety reasons. But I'm not sure, again, why certain companies can and consumers can't.
Okay, and then another call on the line, Scott from Palolo.
Yes, aloha. I'm the volunteer communications director for a organization here in Hawaii called Hawaii Advocates for Consumer Rights. We're in our third decade in Hawaii, and have studied and followed the effort to convert to solar, including we went through the Next Era hearings and all of that. And but the reason I'm calling is back to storage. If you think about every battery that we as individuals are used, and multiply that by the millions and millions and millions of people around the world who are using these little batteries, those are lithium batteries are made of rare earths, and they call them rare earths because they're rare. Unfortunately, many of these rare earths are controlled by China and Russia. We do not recycle these little individual batteries. Now we come to the matter of major storage capacity for HECO. The systems that we have for electric cars, those are, of course, those batteries are recycled and redone. But here's my question. Are you not very concerned that the storage capacity that would be necessary to run a city the size of Honolulu is frankly impossible simply because of the limitations? I'll leave you with this. Just look at what the cost of the little bitty AAA and AA batteries in the last 5 or 6 years. They've doubled. Thank you, but I'd wait for your comments.
Thank you for your comment and question. I think you perhaps touched on a couple of issues that the state really does need to focus on. One is the proper disposal of many of the things that are going into our system right now, including batteries, because as you point out, there are certain rare earth minerals or items that are included in lithium ion or even in the PV panels that are being used. And what we don't want is that, you know, these things just go into our landfills and somehow then adversely affect our environment. So that's one of the issues that we have raised in a number of proceedings before the commission in terms of making sure that there is a plan to deal with some of these projects after it's time for those projects to be decommissioned. And the other point you raised with respect to the costs, I think it raises an aspect of planning that, again, has been raised before the Public Utilities Commission in the sense that we can't just rely on PV and storage, because if we do, it will be very costly. And actually, it's not a good way to run your system, because going back a few years, I think it might have been 2005, 2006, when we looked at about 40 days of rain. If all of our energy is provided by the sun and using storage, unless we put in a massive amount of storage, there's no way our system would be able to withstand a prolonged period of rain or cloudy days. So we are going to have to look at a number of different solutions. PV and storage right now is a very cost-effective one, or it's become a very cost-effective one, but it can't be the only solution we look at as we move forward towards the 100% renewable portfolio standard, because it is expensive. One of our concerns is we don't want to put in capacity that basically just sits around and does nothing, because then consumers are paying for something that we're not getting full value for. So we are going to have to look at a number of solutions, and not just storage and not just PV.
You are with the conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Our studio guest is Dean Nishina, the state consumer advocate. We invite you to call and join the discussion by calling 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We have about 10 minutes left. But let's talk a little bit more, Dean, with this idea of what happens when things get decommissioned. Because I just saw something about what do we do with the wind turbines when their life is up, if it's 20 years, 30 years, and it's a challenge. They're big.
They are. I mean, it's a challenge bringing them in, and it is similarly a challenge in terms of when they're ready to be decommissioned. I think, you know, there are some wind farms on the mainland where once it's decommissioned, they just leave them standing there, and we certainly don't want that to happen on our islands. So I know that's one of the issues we've been trying to drive before the Public Utilities Commission. Again, making sure that there's a plan when it's decommissioned that hopefully the land can be restored to the way it was, rather than just having these wind turbines stand there where they are, or maybe these PV panels just staying where they are. We need to have some plan in place to make sure that we can decommission these plants without adversely affecting the communities and the environment as a whole.
Right, and my understanding in reading this article was that the blades are huge and not easily dealt with. I think someone was exploring the idea of grinding them up and recycling them in some other form, but otherwise they stand to take a lot of space in the landfill.
Right, exactly. And again, that's an issue that we're trying to make sure that the developer, when they come in, will have something in play, because unfortunately we don't have recycling resources on the island per se. So in terms of whether it's dismantling and grinding up or however they might dispose of, say, the turbines or the blades, it will likely involve having to ship those off island so that it doesn't just sit somewhere in our landfills.
Right. So right near on Oahu, we've got the ones up in Kahuku.
Right.
We've got a second one being proposed. We've got one proposed at Palihua Ridge.
Right.
On the west side.
Right.
And there are, I think, a couple of companies that expressed interest in offshore wind
floating
devices.
Wind turbines, yeah. Yep.
So how are we looking at those?
Well, right now, the offshore wind turbines are still very much in the planning stages, because significant areas of ocean around our islands are somewhat restricted by the military in terms of what can go on over there. So until those issues are resolved, we really won't be able to see offshore wind. And another thing is the costs associated with those wind turbines really aren't too competitive right now with some of the other options that we're looking at. As it relates to some of those other proposals, I know, again, going back to my earlier comment, this is where we need to make sure that we seek community input as early as possible to see whether or not those projects can move forward. Because if the community opposes it, I think, you know, that's where the developers should step back and try to understand, okay, why are there concerns with these projects? And they can't just expect that they can move forward. And I know people sometimes say, you know, we have to ignore NIMBYism, but I think that's the wrong attitude to take, because, you know, we live on a very small island. Everybody's opinions are important, especially the community in which these projects are going up in. So if we try to move forward without taking into consideration those community concerns, it may actually delay the project so that it never goes in. So again, it doesn't make sense to ignore those comments. We need to try to address those comments as early as possible.
And I know there's not a lot of these in the U.S. I think there's more in Europe, the offshore
wind
projects.
I think there are a few. My understanding is there are a number off the East Coast, maybe off the coast of Massachusetts.
And
part of that is the difference in terms of the way the drop-off occurs off the shore, because, again, as I understand it, in Massachusetts, the shoreline, once you get away from it, it's still very shallow when you go potentially maybe up to a mile out. Whereas with Hawaii, once you get a few hundred yards out, it just drops significantly. So in terms of being able to have anchored offshore wind turbines, it's much easier to build those as opposed to trying to develop offshore wind projects that aren't really anchored. It's going to have to rely on a unique system in terms of trying to keep those wind turbines in place and still be able to connect it to the islands to deliver the power.
And that's got to go through the Federal Bureau of Oceans, I think.
Yeah, there are a number of permits that would need to be met and obtained before those offshore wind turbines could go into play.
Okay, we have another call coming in from Maui. Allison, you have a question?
Hi. I'm wondering, harking back to the HECO discussion, has there ever been any historical analysis of some of the profits or whatever it is that you're looking at as far as benefit to the organization compared to the what was produced and used by the public? And I don't have to stay on the line. You can just answer that.
So consumer benefits versus company benefits, I guess.
So I hope I answer your question, Allison. We continually look at the achieved results of operations as opposed to what the authorized rate of return is. And again, historically, I think there have been only a few times that the company has when I say the company, Maui Electric, Hawaiian Electric, Hawaii Electric Light, have ever actually achieved the authorized rate of return. So if that's a metric to be looked at, I would have to offer that the companies haven't achieved that authorized rate of return. In terms of being able to take what they've earned back to maybe the benefit or the value to the customers, that's one of the things we're trying to look within the new performance-based regulation dockets, where we can try to identify certain objectives and outcomes that is in the consumer's interest, in the state's interest. And depending on how well the company does there, that's going to influence how much of a profit they might be able to make after we do that assessment. So again, we're trying to move forward to, rather than just looking at how much they spent in terms of capital investment and that's how their profits determine, we're looking at, have they been successful in meeting certain identified objectives and outcomes, and then determining what type of profit they might be able to make.
Okay. About 2 minutes left. Anything else you want to underscore to our listeners? Anything else you've got coming down the pipeline?
Well, there's always a number of things within the pipeline. I think we touched upon a number of the major issues. You know, one thing I would throw out, again, we're really concerned with customer equity, because right now a lot of the things that have been happening, I think, you know, people who have who are more affluent, I think, have been able to take advantage of things. When we talk about energy efficiency, the original energy efficiency plans that were out there, if you bought, say, a new refrigerator, you could go and get a rebate. But if you're low income or a vulnerable customer, you may not have the money to buy that new refrigerator in order to get the rebate. Similarly, if you were able to spend the money to put a PV system and maybe a battery on your house, you could then get that tax credit. But again, if you don't have the money, you really can't do that. So what we're trying to advance is the idea of customer equity, making sure that even, you know, vulnerable customers, low-income customers, might be able to get some relief from their bills. I think, if listeners are interested, one of the things our office is trying to do is push the idea of a state low-income home energy assistance program, so that we can maybe help more customers. There is a federal low-income home energy assistance, if I can, I'm going to use the acronym LIHEAP. There's a federal program, but that's somewhat limited. So what we're trying to see is whether or not we can expand that program so that more customers might be able to benefit and help address some of those energy bills that they've been getting. I think it's a really important topic that has somewhat fell through the cracks, and we're trying to make sure that we address those issues.
Okay, so we'll be hearing more about that.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. We'd like to thank our guests, Dean Nishina, the State Consumer Advocate, and we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us and calling in on today's show. And if your call didn't make it on the air, contact the Talkback line and leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation Podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.